Greetings to all of God's people.
And I believe we are now in lesson 122. And last time we finished with the thought. Well, I think we said enough about that, and I hope that it is clearer in the minds of many. I did not intend to go this long, but I think that for the future study, as we're going to go through the scriptures to have a better knowledge and understanding of God, and when we come to scriptures that don't seem to be very clear, we should strive harder to know our God so we can have a better knowledge and understanding of the way His mind works and His nature and character, because that's what God desires from us. And when we do so, it will be much easier, because we're going to go through many scriptures, especially when you come to the details of the book of the law, that many of us, because we live in the 20th century, so far away from the religion of the fathers, so far away from the religion of our even rebellious ancient forefathers, Israelites, well, they did many of those things, and they did not have difficulty with it, but we do, because of 2,000 years especially of brainwashing by false church and false doctrines and false ideas, that now many of these laws will think, well, that's far out, that's not for us, you know, how can they do it? And that could be about this item or that item or the other. So at least hopefully that instead of that state of mind, we're going to develop a desire to know Yehovah, to know Him far beyond just I know His name, you see, but an intimate knowledge of Him, a very, very intimate knowledge of Him, so we can begin to see everything that we're going to read as we continue from His point of view. And if we don't have it, be willing to put aside our feelings and emotions of the moment and dig very deeply into it so that we may gain that knowledge and understanding. And that's what oftentimes you see that bumper sticker statement, you know, to know me is to love me. People do not know God. They don't love Him. That's the reason why we have a problem. We have many problems. Because we do not know God as we should. Therefore, we don't love Him as we should, and we don't love our neighbors either. And so it's important to think about it from this point of view. I wanted to bring also another point, I think in lesson, was that 119, probably 119, when I began talking about Abraham coming into the land of Canaan. He came to a city called Ai. And I was mentioning that Ai was a city that deceived, in essence, the people of the city deceived Joshua later on by saying that they came from a far away, and that was a mistake on my part, correction here. This I was thinking about the city of Gibeon, not Ai. Ai was a city that Joshua had difficulty with, and he could not win the battle against them right after Jericho because of the sin of Achan, where he took items from Jericho against the very, very specific dictate of Joshua and of God not to touch anything out of that city. So anyway, I was mixing these two cities. Just wanted to make a correction there. People may listen to that, and you know how people are. I say, well, you know, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, sometimes when you speak and you know, things slip out of your mind and you say things that you should not say, but at least when it comes to your attention, you should be willing to come back and retrace your steps and correct yourself and then continue from that point of view. And God is gracious to us. We should be gracious to one another. And the more we know God, the more we are that way. Well, anyway, now we're back again to Genesis chapter 12 and verse 8, where we began the whole journey from that point of view. And so we read again in verse 8, "And he removed from thence unto the mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Ai," that's the other city that gives Joshua a hard time. I thought it was Gibeon. "And Ai on the east. And he built an altar unto Jehovah, and called upon the name of Jehovah." So it's not that he just called upon his name. This is just an idiom to say to you that Abraham is having a relationship with his Creator, with his God, in whom he believes, for whose sake he was willing to depart totally from his country, because he was already having a relationship with him. So it just doesn't mean that he built an altar and says, "Oh, Jehovah," and that was it. No, he's having a relationship with him there. He's talking to him. He's fellowshipping before him. He killed a sacrifice, so he sits down and he eats before him. You see, much goes into that. But obviously the scripture is not going to explain everything, but the ones who are wise, who can discern, they study the background, the context, and they gain much more than what is found on the surface. And most people just study the surface, and because they do, that's how they study God. And because they do, they don't know God. They don't know Jehovah. You see, God wants us to know Him far beyond. Not to say, well, I read the Scripture, I read it a long time ago, that's it, I don't want to hear it anymore. People like that, God is not going to be known to them, He's not going to make Himself known to them. You see? He may in certain little areas, but people who really want to know Him all the way should go all the way with Him. And so, this is what Abraham does at this point. He has a very heavy relationship with his Creator now. Far beyond just building an altar and sacrificing on it. You see? His heart is there. His mind is there. His being is there. Everything is there. His obedience. His faithfulness. And so he's having relationship with his Creator. And so you should read the Bible and go far beyond what you see on the surface. In verse 9, and Abraham journeyed, going on still toward the south. In other words, he's going in stages because, you know, he's walking gradually, and he has a great entourage with him, lots of animals and slaves and all that. So gradually he's inching his way toward the south, that is toward the Negev. And apparently the reason why he went over there, well, most of the land being fertile was taken, obviously, by the Canaanites. So he needs to go to a place where it's, you know, it's a little bit more free. Just like today, you know, if you are here in California, in the Los Angeles area, everything is busy and expensive and all that, and a place to, that you can go and find something that is more affordable, or at least open and free, it's further outside of the outskirts of the city into the wilderness here. Those who know this area. And so this is what Abraham is doing. He's, you know, he's walking by and said, well, I cannot stay here, and I cannot stay here, and I cannot stay here, I got to keep going. You know, this whole people, the whole land is full of people. And he's not complaining, by the way. You know, the God told him, go to the land of Canaan, and he goes there, and it's mostly occupied. Well, he goes to where he can find a space, and there he stays. You know, he stops. And that's what he's doing, going toward the south. Now, of all things, as it goes toward the south, it's a dry area, it says in verse 10, and there was a famine in the land. And he says, oh man, what did I do? Why did I follow God? Everything is bad. You know, I cannot find a space here for me. The land is not fertile. I know where I am going. I'm going to the south, to the Negev. And on top of that, I've got a famine. Well, the first bad experience that Abraham has with his God. But you see, Abraham knows his God. He knows his God. He knows Jehovah. And so he doesn't worry too much about it. On the other hand, why he went down to Egypt, why God brought the famine at that time? Was it a test that it was going to bring upon Abraham? The Scripture doesn't let us know, but obviously those things don't happen. There are no coincidences when God is dealing with His own people. All those things have a meaning. And so we have to take it from that point of view. There was a purpose for it. There was a purpose for God to bring him into Egypt and what He was going to do there. He was going to fulfill His will, and oftentimes God doesn't tell us what He's going to do, what He's about to do. As we go through it, as we experience what He does, then we know Him that way. And sometimes God allows us to know what He's going to do, but not always. In most cases, He doesn't. And so we have to follow Him by faith, know that He is, and please Him that way. As God later on will say, without faith, you cannot please God. You cannot come to God. For only those who have faith in Him and know that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. And Abraham was in that state of mind. So he said, okay, well, God will bring the famine, and who knows what went behind the scenes there. But Abraham goes down to Egypt. And so, it says, and it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said to Sarai his wife, behold, now I know that you are a fair woman to look upon. And it will come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see you, that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but you they will keep alive. Now, what's happening here? I mean, doesn't he trust God that God will protect him, protect his wife, you know, that he has to go through that? And how come he didn't do it so far until this point? At least we don't hear about it that he did. What we read here, that he told her that as they were entering into Egypt. And, you know, there are a lot of things in the background here that will tell you what's happening. One of it is, it was well known that the Egyptian kings, maybe the Canaanites were not that bad, but the Egyptian kings, you know, when they saw a beautiful woman, maybe they didn't have too many beautiful women there, when they saw a beautiful one coming from one of those nomads that constantly came into Egypt when they had famine or when they needed some to make a living, and they will just pick all the beautiful immigrants that came, or anybody that they saw, and take it to the Pharaoh. Well, that was very simple. And the way they did it,
They killed the men. So Abraham knew all about it, and so all that is on his mind. And that's what he says at this point. This is what he tells her. And it's very interesting to see the way things happen. God, what He deals with us, does not necessarily intervene in every tiny little detail of our life. He lets us do all kind of things. He lets us experience all kind of experiences in life. He lets us walk with Him at our own space, you know, at our own way, the way we desire to walk with Him, to whatever degree we commit ourselves to Him in every detail. And, you know, He wants us to practice life, to experience life. He's not going to control everything that we do, everything that we say, everything that we want to do apart from Him. And so that's basically, you're going to see Abraham and others, and all of us are getting into all kind of either mischief or trouble or things that God allows and causes to bring things out of it. And so, as you study the story of Abraham and everyone else down the road in our own lives, and we should examine our own lives and study our own lives too, to see how things were done and how God was in it and how much we really knew God in those moments. And so this is where we find ourselves here. Or anyway, this is what Abraham is doing at this point. Now, why is he saying that? Why is he telling her, say that you are my sister? As we proceed further into Genesis chapter 20, we see that another case just like that happened to him, this time when he went back to the land of Canaan with the king of the Philistines, Abimelech. And he just repeated the same thing again. And so he says to the king, what he asked him, why did you do that? Why did you tell me that she is your sister? Well, Abraham replies in verse 11, in chapter 20, and Abraham said, because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place. And people don't fear God, you know, just like Pharaoh. And that's kind of rulers. You know, rulers think that they can do anything they want just because they've got the power. They're no different today. They're no different in the church either. Because they've got power, they think they can do whatever they want. And so he says, surely the fear of God, well, this is what he thought, is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. And moreover, now he's explaining, I wasn't really lying. It's in one way half a lie, but on the other hand, it's true. You know, one of those things that is half true and half not, if you tell the whole story. Verse 12, and moreover, she is indeed my sister. So when he says she's my sister, it's not a lie. The daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And so she became my wife. And it came to pass, in verse 13, when God caused me to wonder, you see, God is the one that caused me to wonder for my father's house, that I said unto her, this is your kindness which you shall show unto me. At every place whether we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. So he says, you know, I didn't really lie, but of course, he was in a very tough spot there, and therefore, he, you know, just like the scripture later on will tell us, that is Jesus Christ's instruction, you have to be shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove. So, you know, you have to know how to maneuver your way in a world that is very wicked. After all, they don't go by your standards, you don't live by their standards, and somewhere, somehow, you know, you're going to have to maneuver your way there. And on one hand, Abraham was not lying, so you cannot say that he was a liar. See, Abraham had to make a decision. You know, there are times in life where we just have to make a decision. How are we going to tackle the situation? And you don't have to say everything. Just because you don't say everything, you see, this concept of tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, well, that's generally speaking among honest people. But, you know, a thief comes into your home, wants to steal everything that you have, and he says, well, do you have any other money here, you know, that you hid somewhere in the closet, or whatever it may be? Why are you going to tell him that? He just said, no, I don't have any money. In other words, I don't have any money for you. You see? Well, you can say, well, you lied to me. You better speak the truth. You're a servant of God. Well, that's foolishness, and we have to use wisdom in those kind of matters. And so when we know God, when we understand God, we shall know that too. Because later on we shall come through some examples that I may bring, or God Himself told people, you don't necessarily have to tell the whole thing, the whole truth, you know, the truth and nothing but the truth. One example that I can bring right here at this point, and then we'll proceed with Samuel. Samuel needed, well, God told him, you're going to anoint David. And Samuel said, no way, I'm going to anoint David, you know, I'll take, you know, a sacrifice and go down there, you know, anoint David. Saul will hear about it and he's going to kill me. And God said, well, don't worry about it. You just take a lamb with you and just tell him you're going down to Bethlehem there to offer a sacrifice, you know, and have a religious ceremony there and service with the people there. In other words, you don't have to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. What does that mean? Is he telling him to lie? He's not lying. He's doing just that. But he's doing other things and doesn't need to tell him about everything. That's exactly what Christ was talking about. You've got to be shrewd as a serpent. As you deal with a world that is very devious and very sinister and very wicked, you have to be shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove. In other words, shrewd as a serpent, you have to maneuver your way around it. You see? We don't have to tell everything. And then on the other hand, harmless as a dove, where you do not become an absolute liar or evildoer. You see? So you have to maneuver between both. And the people that do not know God, who are children in that knowledge of God, you know, they don't know how to function that way properly. And they need to be mature and learn and understand all those things. Well, anyway, this is where Abraham found himself with the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. And this is what he had to do, and that's what he did. And obviously, the Pharaoh, once he found out that that was not the case, he was not too happy about it. But the reality was, he was the guilty one. He cannot blame Abraham for it. He should have pointed the finger at himself. Instead of that, being carnal, and at the same time scared to death, realizing that God was in it. In those days, people were much more superstitious, unlike people today who have no faith, no belief in God whatsoever. In those days, even though they were idol worshippers, at least they understood that when things happen in life, which seem to be out of the ordinary, there are divine powers, there are spirit beings out there, and there are those things that are caused by them. And so they acknowledge them. And so Pharaoh, realizing, you know, all the evils that came upon his own house, and we don't know exactly, you know, the rabbis try to speculate that maybe he got totally inflicted Pharaoh and all of his servants with some kind of sexual disease or whatever it may be. Pharaoh, in either case, reacted based on that, and he had also his wise man, religious man, that would tell him, hey, you're doing something wrong here, and the gods are angry with you. Better find out. And he may have been inspired to realize that it was because of what he had done to Abraham, taking his wife. Well, one way or the other, there are obviously certain details that are not mentioned how it happened. He found himself in that position, and he went back to Abraham, and he told him that what you have done was not right. And so, in verse 17, because of that, we read, well, prior to that, you know, he had taken his wife, and because he allowed him to take his wife without any protest at the time. And verse 14, it came to pass that when Abraham was come to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld a woman, that she was fair, and the princes saw her. So, you know, you get the impression it's a small country, so to speak, small world. Everybody sees everybody, and especially if you pass through the either a gate or whatever they had there, you know, the customs or whatever it may be. Somebody stood there and noticed that, and they told somebody else, and they told the princess, and the princess told Pharaoh. So it must have been something that they were doing it as a matter of fact. And so they told him, and well, he said, let's do it as we always do it. We take the man. In this case, they didn't kill him, because he didn't say that's his wife. If he said it was his wife, they would have killed him. Since he said she was my sister, they did not. And so, to compensate him for it, well, to reward him for it, not compensate him, the Pharaoh gave him an awful lot of things. So we read in verse 16, and he dealt well with Abraham for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen, and he asses, and men servants and maid servants, and she asses and camels. In other words, Sarah to him was such a great prize that he was willing to just abundantly give him all these things. And who knows, maybe God worked it out in such a way to enrich his servant Abram. And God has his own ways of doing things that we cannot think about the moment. And yet he brings an awful lot of good out of it. So Sarah was not touched by the Pharaoh because God took care of that. And you don't see any, at least we don't see in the scriptures, anything on the part of God, where he gets angry at Abraham for doing that and lets him know about it and scolds him. We don't see any of that. So, to one degree, you know, you might say that it wasn't really his fault. I mean, what else could he do? In other words, if you live in a world that is made of wolves and you're a sheep, you're going to get into trouble here and there, not because of you, but because of them. And that's when you pray to God to ask Him to deliver you out of the situation. So you find things like that. And in delivering, you see that God not only delivered Abraham from that and delivered Sarah from that shame and humiliation, but He also rewarded him through Pharaoh with an abundance of treasures and riches, and you know, riches of the time. Not gold and silver. You notice here there is no mention of gold and silver and money, but the things that really counted in those days. And that's the animals and the servants. And verse 17, and the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, so you can see the link was made there, one way or the other. Maybe he even spoke to him in a dream, because he had done it before that. Maybe he had done it exactly the same way that he did with Abimelech later on, as we'll come to that, we'll read it. With Abimelech, where the same story happened, God actually came to him in a dream, to the king, and told him, you better not touch that woman. She's married. And maybe he had done the same thing with Pharaoh. It's not mentioned here, but if he did it later on, maybe he did it here too. Because as soon as he plagued him, we see that Pharaoh responds, knowing what's happening. And so he plagued him, and immediately as a result, Pharaoh called Abram, verse 18, and said, what is it that you have done unto me? And so, obviously, God must have let him know one way or the other that he was behind it. And he says, why didn't you tell me that she was your wife? And that's in essence hypocritical on the part of Pharaoh. He should have known it. Nobody's going to say that if he's afraid for his life, because the way you always act, you take, you know, somebody's wife and you kill him. What do you expect? But carnal people are not that honest. To put the blame themselves, you know, they always blame somebody else. Verse 19. Why said you, she is my sister, so I took her to be my wife. Now therefore, behold your wife, take her and go away. In other words, get out of the country. Because on the one hand, he was angry. On the other hand, he was also afraid that, you know, if he stays around, somebody else might do the same. One of his princes. And then he's going to be affected by it. And others too. So he says, just get out, totally get out of the country. You know, I'll give you anything you need. Just get out of here. And you can see, in essence, something similar that happened later on. When God caused his people, Israel, to end up in the land of Egypt. And then he plagued the Pharaoh, and he plagued his country, and he brought Pharaoh to the point, to that state of mind, where he would send him away, you know, just throw them out of the country, so to speak, as you see here in that sense. And then, at the same time, also, he lavished on them, and his people did also, abundance of treasures. And so, it's interesting to see a similarity here. With the father of the faithful, with the patriarch of the children of Israel, and then they too went through the same experience in a different way. Of course, Abraham was innocent. He was not like his children later on, who became idolatrous, and because of that went into captivity. Some people don't realize why the children of Israel went into captivity in Egypt. Why were they in bondage? Why were they suffering all this time? The thing that just an evil king rose and that was it. They got in trouble. It didn't happen that way. Scripture makes it very plain. And you can read it in Ezekiel in specific, Ezekiel 20. You can read it in Ezekiel 16. You can read it in Ezekiel 23. And other places. But especially in those places, God goes into detail. In detail, he's explaining the whole situation. That his people became idolaters. They became rich. They were well-to-do. They relaxed their standards. They became like the people of the land. And they say, let us be like all the other nations. You know, just, I was a visual state of mind of the children of Israel to this very day. We want to go mainstream. Nothing new about it. And so they go all the way down the drain. God says, okay, that's the way you want it. I'll teach you a lesson. And that's where the captivity came, in bondage. And then he's the one that caused that king in Egypt, you know, the Pharaoh, to turn against his own people. And he caused different circumstances. As we know from history, that in the days of Joseph, there was a different kind of people that ruled Egypt, you know, called the Hyksos, that were basically from the land of Canaan, and they were more benevolent. And then the natives took finally over and kicked the others out, and obviously they were not too happy with the children of Israel, and that's where you see the turn of event. But you can see God was behind it. Well, here Abraham is not guilty of that, and so he gets scot-free, without bondage, without affliction, without oppression, and he just gets out of the country. And so he sends him away, just like he did later on with his own descendants, only under, you know, different circumstances. And verse 20, and Pharaoh gave men charge concerning him. So he wanted to make sure. So he sent his soldiers, says, you make sure that, you know, he gets out of the country. And they brought him on the way. That means they brought him into the border and said, get out of here. You know, we don't want to get punished anymore for your sake, and we want to make sure that you're out of this way and nobody's going to harm you. And on the other hand, and nobody else makes the same mistake by taking your wife. So, safe passage in that way. Escort all the way to the border of Canaan. And so they sent him and all that he had, you know, haven't taken anything from him. And then we continue in chapter 13. And Abraham went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had. You see, this constant mention, all that he had. In other words, he never lost anything out of this ordeal. And Lot with him. So Lot went down with him, obviously, and Lot comes up with him. Now, Lot is mentioned here because God is going to describe something that is going to happen, unfortunately, in circumstances that are not too pleasant for either Abraham or Lot. And so chapter 13 basically talks about it. And so they go back into the south, that means today the Negev. And Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. Now there is a mention of silver and gold. Prior to that, we don't hear any mention of that the Pharaoh gave him silver and gold. But, you know, since he had a lot of cattle, a lot of servants, obviously he's going to have a lot of silver and gold, because he's going to be able to trade. And he went, verse 3, on his journeys from the south. And journeys, you know, is in the plural, because he journeys to a certain place, he stops there, and then he continues, and then he stops there, and he continues, and so you have the plural there, the journeys, from the south, even to Bethel. So he goes back to the same place to which he came earlier, when he came out of the land of Canaan, the house of God, Bethel. Of course, it wasn't called Bethel at the time, but Moses now is describing it. And he's using the name that was given to it later by Jacob, as the grandson of Abraham. But actually, at the time he went to the city called Luz in Hebrew, or Laz in English, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. And verse 4, or obviously it had to be between Bethel and Ai, because Bethel was a city, Ai was a city, and obviously it could not be there, because that was taken, occupied. And so he dwelt somewhere in the open country between those two cities. And he went unto the place of the altar which he had made at the first, and Abraham called there on the name of Jehovah. Again, you know, as we mentioned earlier. So again, the altar was already there, and this is where God appeared to him at that point, and so God brings him to the same place, and he's renewing, in essence, his relationship with him in one sense. And at that point, he calls upon his name. What does it mean he calls upon his name? As we mentioned earlier, he has a fellowship with him. He sacrifices to him. He communes with him. And that's what it means. And he knows him. And that's what it means to call upon the name of the Lord. It's, as I mentioned earlier, it's an idiomatic concept, not just saying, oh God, or whatever. It goes far beyond that, speaking about a relationship. Verse 5. And Lot also, who went with Abraham, had flocks and herds and tents. And so, it's not, as I mentioned earlier, they like to picture it in the movie. If you saw the movie The Bible, The show Abraham is a nomad. You know, he comes over there, you know, with a few people around him and 20 goats or something like that. And that is totally gross misconception of reality. Abraham and Lot, and especially Abraham, was known, and historic records are there for us to check. Josephus talks about it, that Abraham was a mighty, mighty prince, to the point that many were afraid of him. And you're not a mighty prince when you've got a couple of goats, you know, or 20 goats, or a few servants. He was a very rich man. And so Lot also was with him, and he went with Abraham, and he had flocks and tents, in verse 6, and the land was not able to bear them, that they may dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. Now to begin with, the land is occupied by the Canaanites. And the open fields were not that large and that great for them to dwell together and have enough water. And water was always a problem in that area, and it still is to this very day. Many of the wars that occurred in that area was because of water. There just isn't enough water until God blessed it when He brought His people, the children of Israel, and even that time it was abundantly blessed, but God blessed it even so much more so when He brought the children of Israel to that land and gave it to them. As He told them, you know, if you're obedient to me, you'll have rain in due season. First rain, latter rain, and He blessed it abundantly. But still, when God did not send the rain, since they didn't have the big rivers there, like they did, you know, in Egypt or the Euphrates, they depended very much on rain. And if it didn't rain, well, the wells were empty. And so it's been always a problem like that there. And I think God made it specifically that way. You know, they had big rivers there. These problems wouldn't be there, and then on the other hand, God always used this reality in that land, so people who are there, which obviously were to be the people of Israel, will depend on Him for rain, instead of saying, well, who needs you, God? We've got rivers. And that's what they did in Egypt, you know, they considered the river a god. They worshipped the Nile, and had no need for God, because they thought, you know, we don't need God, we've got water. But when you depend on God, you become faithful and abiding in His faith, and you seek His will, and you seek His His path, so it may be well with you. And God wanted Israel to depend on Him and not just to look to their own selves. That's what happens in this country. For example, there are so many riches, so many rivers, so many lakes, that people say, we don't need God, we've got it all here. We can do on our own without His help. And so, in verse 6, they had a problem, too much substance, mighty, both of them, and the land was just not enough. And so they could not dwell together. Now what happens when that is a reality? Now, the shepherds that take care of their flocks have a problem. And so they fight with each other. And so we read in verse 7, and there was a strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. There wasn't a strife between Abram and Lot. You know, it's a lower level, so to speak. The shepherds were fighting constantly, you know, who's going to be first at the well. And why they didn't bring it to the attention of their masters, we don't know. They were just fighting. And so there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt then in the land. In other words, that was one of the major problems. Canaanites were there, Perizzites were there, much of the land was taken, much of the fertile areas were taken in that land, and what was left was not enough. And so, verse 8, and Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and you, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Well, they were more than just brothers. Lot was his nephew, and he was his adopted son in one sense. Since he had no father, Abraham took care of him, so he became sort of an adopted son to him. And he said, you know, in other words, in the family, we should not be fighting. You know, we are men of God, we are servants of God, we should not be fighting. There is a law of peace. In other words, when you serve God, you are men of peace. You're not a man of war. And people have conflicts, and families have conflicts, and marriages do not do fair, you know, do not do well, do not fare well as they should, and among brothers, and in congregations, and so forth, because people are not men of peace. They do not know the way of peace. The way of peace they know not, as it says in Isaiah. And because of that, they have strife. Now, the shepherds were not obedient to God as they should have been, or else they would have settled it in peace. But Abraham said, we should not be that way. We're a family, and you don't fight in families. And so he says, is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself, I pray you, from before me. If you will take the left hand, then I will go to the right. And if you will take the right hand, then I will go to the left. Now, this is what Abraham does here. He breaks away from law and custom and tradition. You see, the law and the custom and the tradition was not only of Babylon, but any other place. And in many societies to this very day, where they have great respect for the elders, is for the elder to take the first choice. And the other one takes the second choice. In other words, the best choice goes to the elder. Well, Abraham is a very humble man, very obedient man, and he's not about to say, well, Lot, you just get out of here, you know, go somewhere else, find yourself your own place, and let's have peace. I'm going to stick around here. Even though the land was already given to him, even about the land of Canaan that was given to him, he said, you go choose first, wherever you want to go. If you want to stay in the land of Canaan, I'll go somewhere else. And that tells you an awful lot about the father of the faithful. And how many of us are that way? And that's why later on, you know, you read an instruction, which is a law, that you should consider somebody else, your brother, better than yourself. You see, most people like to consider themselves better than others, and so they want to take the, you know, the first choice. But when you are in that state of mind, like Father Abraham, where you consider somebody else better than yourself, then it's not difficult for you to speak like that and feel that way and give him the first choice. And that's exactly what Abraham is doing. So that tells you a lot about the character of Abraham and why God also chose Abraham and how he's dealing with him and what kind of state of mind Abraham was in. And also it tells you an awful lot that Abraham was raised, Lot should have been the same way, but you know, Lot was not the same as Abraham. He was raised in a law-abiding family that knew the laws of God. Some people don't realize that. You know, they think that Abraham came from a pagan environment, and therefore everybody was pagan, his father was pagan, and they were all idol worshippers. Yes, idol worship was a problem in the family, obviously. We find it later on, again, you know, in the family of Isaac and the family of Jacob, where in the family of Abraham that stayed behind in Haran, they worshipped God on one hand because they knew the law of God, they knew the ways of God, but also, just like the children of Israel were always, they worshipped God and also they had their idols. Not totally pure as they should have been. And Abraham totally came out of it, and he would not allow any of that. And obviously Lot too was not idol worshippers either. And so, abiding by the law of God, the law of peace, the way of peace, he says, okay, I know my rights, I'm the elder, I'm sure I should have, you know, the best choice and all that, but I'll let you have the first one. And it's interesting that Lot allowed that, whether you can call it covetousness or who knows, you know, we do not want to judge a man that was called righteous. Instead of saying, no, Abraham, you know, you're the elder, you should have the first choice, he said, okay, whatever you say. And that also tells you a little bit about Lot in comparison to Abraham, his uncle, and also his adopted father. And so he says, you lift up, well, it says in verse 10, and Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan that was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, they didn't go in that direction before that, where they could have done it before. You know, why were they fighting? They should have gone over there and had better place for their flocks. Well, they did not go there because God told Abraham, the land of Canaan is yours, not the land on the other side. And so Lot went over there, he lifted up his eyes, and he saw the whole area was well watered. I mean, it must have been there before that, so they knew the area. And it was a beautiful land, just like you might say the America today. A glorious, you know, gorgeous land. Beautiful piece of real estate. And a perfect, ideal place for flocks. That was one of the problems of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abundance, riches. They were well-to-do people. You know, in today's terminology in this area, in California, you say the Beverly Hills, or any other rich area in this country. And they allowed the riches to go into their head, and so they became corrupt. They had plenty of time on their hand, and so that's what people do when they had plenty. Instead of being like Father Abraham, using the riches to glorify and honor God and remain faithful and humble, and really not look to their riches for their security and defense, but look to God. And Abraham looked even beyond that. He did not even look to this life for defense and sustenance. He looked, as we read later on in the book of Hebrews, he lived life by looking into a city whose builder and maker is not God. And so he was not even interested at this point to build a city for himself. He could have. He was a mighty prince. But he lived as a sojourner. Temporary life. And so as such, his whole being and heart and devotion was to God and not to man-made achievements and accomplishments. And so Lot looked over there and he saw it was a glorious land. It was the land that well-watered. Before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go unto Zoar. In other words, since there was water in all those areas, the land looked very good. And verse 11, so Lot chose him all the plain. He chose to himself all the plain of the Jordan. Apparently it was empty still. And Lot journeyed east. And they separated themselves, the one from the other. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, because that's exactly the way God wanted it to be. And you can see that also God worked out circumstances here to bring a separation between the two. Because he wanted Abraham, who became Abraham, to be the one that he's working with, and to him to give the promises and the covenants. And we're talking about an eternal future here. And so he did not want anybody around. No cousins, no relatives, no uncles, no nephews, no whatever it may be, only Abraham. And it is through Abraham he was going to start his church, you might say, his family, his people, the wife that he will give to his son in the future, and the wife that he gave to his son in Sinai. And he wanted that to be only through Abraham. Then later on he made plain that he doesn't want Ishmael. Later on he made plain he doesn't want Esau. So he was choosing all along the ones, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and through them, you see, to form his people, the body of witnesses, because he had eternal purpose for them, and through them to bring all mankind. So he was creating the selective process here, and creating circumstances to bring about the separation. And so Lot chose him all the plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves, the one from the other. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now, why would he go that close to Sodom? He should have known the reputation of it. Well, that's something else they forgot to judge. All we know that he ended up in Sodom and Gomorrah, finally in the city itself, not only outside. You know how it is. You get used to the area, and then gradually get closer and closer. And that's a lesson for us, to depart as far as we can from the spiritual Sodom and Gomorrah we see all around us. Because the closer we get to it, the more we get used to it, and the more we let down our standards, and we become familiarized with it, and therefore comfortable with it, and before we know it, we're in the midst of it. And God tells us, come out of Babylon. We've got the same problem today. You know, come out of Sodom and Gomorrah of the day. Come out of it. And people are getting used to the world in which they are, and they become a part of it. And they say, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. Why can't I use the way they worship God? And so forth and so forth. And then God told Israel, you don't be like that. You know, you don't worship me the way the heathen do. And today we do the same in many areas. We don't even realize it. We don't see any wrong, you know, with the many, many items on a religious basis that the people around us are doing. And we say, well, we can do it too, you know, to worship God. And to the point where people actually went back, you know, very plainly, went back to the keeping of Christmas and the keeping of this and that and Sunday and everything else, because they don't see anything wrong with that. See? Like Lot, they journeyed toward the glorious, beautiful land, you know, that looked like the Garden of Eden. They didn't see anything wrong with that. And before they knew it, they end up in the midst of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's exactly what happened to Lot. And you know what were the results of that? They didn't want to come out of it. God made him come out of it by destroying the whole area. And so he lost everything. You know, many of his family members were all gone. You know, they were zapped, evaporated. That's what God says. You come out of Babylon, unless you want to be partakers of her, you know, plagues and destruction, you better come out of it. And those who are not going to listen to the voice of God as it speaks to them through the prophets to come out of Babylon, they're going to have to experience what Lot did later on, where he ended up with his two daughters, and you know what happened then. And so we read about Abram. On the other hand, Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Verse 13, now the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. And you would think, you know, you want to get away as far as possible from that, regardless of all the riches around it. Poverty is better than being in the midst of riches with wickedness, but poverty with righteousness is better. And God was not offering poverty to begin with. Yet we view it sometimes that way. Anyway, we shall stop at this point. And this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.